During an ecumenical meeting, someone rushed in and shouted, "The building is on fire." The Methodists gathered in the corner and had a prayer meeting. The Baptists cried, "Where's the water?" The Presbyterians elected a chairman who was to appoint a committee to look into the matter. Sounds familiar. The Christian scientists agreed among themselves there was no fire. The fundamentalists shouted, "This is the vengeance of God." The Lutherans, after debating for a while, posted a notice declaring that fire is evil. The Quakers praised God for all the blessings that fire brings. The Jews posted symbols over the door so that the fire would pass over them harmlessly. The Catholics passed a collection plate one more time. The Episcopalians formed a procession and marched out grandly. The Congregationalists and Unitarians shouted, "Everybody for themselves." Just a couple on the Blue Book bloopers that were here, because these are always wonderful ones. Let's see. The Bible is full of interesting caricatures. God asked Abraham to sacrifice Isaac on Mount Montezuma. Jacob, son of Isaac, sold his brother's birthmark. Jacob was a patriarch who brought up his 12 sons to be patriarchs, but they did not take to it. One of Jacob's sons, Joseph, gave refuse to the Israelites. Pharaoh forced the Hebrew slaves to make bread without straw. Moses led them to the Red Sea, where they made unleavened bread, which is bread made without any ingredients. Afterwards, Moses went up on Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments.
Sinai, right.
David was a Hebrew king skilled at playing the lyre, L-I-A-R. He fought with the philatelists, a race of people who lived in biblical times. Solomon, one of David's sons, had 500 wives and 500 porcupines. Not concubines. Okay. Those are, as I say, wonderful ones. And my funniest is, I had a student, and he obviously a great person of great ability and everything else, because about 25 years later I saw him. He turned out to be a radiologist down at Mayo when I was down visiting at the clinic, one of the hospitals visiting, and I may happen to run into him. His name was Paul Jewell. He doesn't mind that I tell this story. And he was in college, and this is, you know, a long time, 25 years before, and I opened up the cover of the examination book, and all it said was, "Wow, you really fooled me this time." He had no answer. He remembered that examination. He said, "Erling, you remember the examination that I didn't answer, back in college." And I remember it vividly, and it's a good story. Okay. Anyway, today on mainline churches, and the question always comes up at the beginning about definitions. And there are sort of two or three ways of going about definitions here. And one is simply to say that the mainline churches would be, we're talking about the Protestant churches, because in many ways the Catholic Church, especially in the last 20 years, has been mainline. But the mainline churches would be Lutheran, Episcopalian, Presbyterian, the UCC, the Methodist. Another way of looking at that is the churches that came to us from Britain, and the churches that came from Germany and Scandinavia would be the mainline churches. And that's a useful way of looking at things. And now, with the new events that just took place, there's going to be greater cooperation between the Lutherans and the UCC, which is really the Congregational Church, although some people don't like that within the thing, because it was a merger of four smaller churches, the Congregational Church and the ENR and so on. And then it'll be the Episcopalian Church and the Presbyterian Church USA and Reformed Church in America.
Was that approved?
Except for the Episcopalian thing with the Lutherans. But that's going to happen in 2 years. The people who, in fact, who led the opposition, namely El Cui, would be the one, and he's been here many times and so on. He said that since 66% of the delegates, of the Lutheran delegates at Philadelphia, approved it, obviously that's a mandate. I mean, that's clear that they're sending the order, because it lost only by 6 votes. And when you have something that important losing by 6 votes, obviously, they're going to reconsider. They tried to reconsider and have a second vote at the convention, or the conference, but that didn't go through. But there's no question that it'll be put through in 2 years. They meet in the next biennial conference. I don't know where it is. And the Episcopalians have to prove it. They only meet every 3 years. And they'll have to prove this. They'll have to prove it in the year 2000, and we'll do it in 1997. I don't think there's any question that it'll go through. And the other ones went through by like 85-86%, and so on. And the bishops themselves, and the ELCA bishops state themselves, they did not do a good job of informing the people ahead of time what was happening. And there were a lot of, that sounds familiar. Right, and
and there were a lot of... Bishops are out of touch.
Yeah, and some people didn't even know, you know, what this was all about. And some people thought it was a merger, you know, like we're all going to lose our identity and all that sort of thing. And that just, you know, isn't the case. But apparently the one thing among the Lutherans that did hold them up was apostolic succession on the bishops. And that's a dicey kind of thing that you have to approach rather carefully. But I think in 2 years it'll come up. All right, now what that means in terms of the future of the mainstream, you know, nobody knows, but we'll start off with what I've got on the board here and then see what happens. Again, you know, your comments and questions are always very, very welcome on this sort of thing. Another way of looking at this is to make a sort of a textbook differentiation between cult and sect and denomination. And I think that helps us to say, well, what do all these different churches sort of have in common? Well, then, for one thing, obviously, none of these churches that we'll be talking about today or any of the rest of the week here are cults, because a cult depends on, you know, the charisma of one individual with a new revelation who has absolute control over the group. And Koresh or the Heaven's Gate or people like that would be obviously a cult. A sect would be something very much like Jehovah's Witness or Mormons or Seventh-day Adventists, where there is some more flexibility and there is more establishment and there is more sort of bureaucracy and hierarchy and this sort of thing. But basically a sect doesn't encourage what we would call internal difficulty or internal discussion or doesn't have a lot of latitude so far as the teachings are concerned. When you have an adult forum, for instance, with a Mormon church or with Jehovah's Witness, it's a teaching. It's not going in and throwing out something and saying, let's talk about it, because there is one sort of line that's or message or theme that's put forward, and you sort of assent to that. You join the church. It's what we used to say, you know, love it or leave it sort of thing, and there's not much room for that, although they will admit that there is some validity to the other denominations. So this will be said, but every so often you'll find some, you know, really difficult things coming up. If we want to talk some other time about cults, we can do that, because I have a lot of experience with the Moonies back in the 70s and the 80s, and that was an interesting experience, let's just put it that way. And so on. And then the denomination has certain things that it stands for. Clearly it has a historical identity, but it's willing to reach out and interact with other denominations to the greatest degree possible without, you know, sacrificing its whole identity. And the question that we'll be talking about today, obviously, is how far do we go with this sort of thing? How far do we go reaching out? At what point do we sort of sacrifice our Lutheran or our Presbyterian, you know, identity in the name of ecumenicity or goodwill or cooperation or something else like that? Do we really want to become sort of like the little church, the little friendly church on the corner, where you go in and these are growing, and we'll talk about these on Thursday, very popular with a lot of people. They aren't interested very much in denominational identity and loyalty, and the churches that are really, in a sense, growing the fastest, for whatever that tells us, are the independent big churches really out in the suburbs. Very, very, and some of the things we can talk about today, the mega churches are growing. And I've had the opportunity, and I'd be glad to talk about this, having lived now in the Valley for the Phoenix Valley for 3 years, looking at the ELCA version of a mega church, you know, up close. We've got the Community Church of Joy, which is one of a kind. And of course, we have another mega church in the Twin Cities called Mount Olivet, which has 12,000 members. And that's not a mega church in the traditional sense that we're having here. So there are a lot of different ways of looking at it, but I think the fact that the denominations are different from the sects and the cults, and in a way, like the Methodists like to put it, that they have agreed to disagree on certain things, that there is a certain place, and that they aren't really all that worried when they find some people within the denominations who don't agree with it. When's the last time we've had a heresy trial, for instance, in any of the mainline churches? They tried in the Episcopalian Church, what was it, about 6-8 months ago, when there were some bishops who were ordaining gays, and they tried hard, and they couldn't establish the presence really of heresy, because no, you know, a lot of people don't know what don't think that there is such a thing as heresy any longer. But back earlier times, heresy would have been considered very important, but we don't do that at all. In the, you know, just one further example, and then I'll get going on this. In the ELCA, in the valley where, you know, we're in the Grand Canyon Synod, they have a very wide divergence of practice on communion, the Eucharist. And in the church where I'm an associate member, they even have infant communion, which is not something which they have in a lot of other churches. But it's, you know, we know the bishop and everything, and we work things out, and it's done. And people don't get too excited about this, but you try something like that in a sect, like Jehovah's Witness or something else like that, and obviously, you know, this, you won't get the first base on that. Okay, is that just by way of, there's unity, but there's diversity too, and some people want more unity and some people want more diversity, and you're sort of left with, you know, somewhere in the middle. It's like the thing I talked about before the bus is leaving now, so it'll be okay. I'm used to anything with teaching. Bye, baby. I have to tell, my first teaching, everything after my first teaching experience has been easy, because I was a teaching assistant at Madison when I did my graduate work, and my first teaching, I was just raring to get at them. As you can tell, you know, I like being in front of an audience, and I was really raring to get at these kids, and it was in summer school, and in Madison in summer school, those who go to summer school are those who partied the rest of the year and are trying to catch up, you know, down on Langdon Street, is where Greek Row is in Madison. So I had that problem, and the other problem was that it was on Friday, you know, you have the lecture on Monday and Wednesday from the big name, and then the peons, like the TAs, took over on Friday for discussion, and this was at Friday at 3 p.m., right off Lake Mendota, and they would come in their swimming suits, you know, and sit there. Why is that? In those days we took roll. And you got demerits or whatever it was for not showing up and everything. So they had to come, and they would sit there, and they were either, you know, knitting or just sort of thinking about, you know, where the party was going to be that night, or they were playing footsie or you know, whatever this was, and bathing suits dripping. And I was determined, by gosh, and it was supposed to be a discussion, and I talked so much, I don't think they even got a coffin, you know, during the whole 60 minutes, because I was determined to, you know, finally have my chance. So anything, as I say, from that point on has been downhill. It's been easy, and no particular problems. Okay.
You know, just,
sure, please.
Just request, somewhere in the discussion of the day or along the way, talked about the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, because a lot of Missouri Synod people that are involved in Holden even now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are still on board.
How they fit in this mainline phenomenon.
Sure.
What's happening.
Remind me on that, but I'd be happy to. There's diversity within Missouri. It's not uniform by any means. We have, in Northfield, we have a remarkably open Missouri church. Steve Dilser is the pastor there, and he's open. When we went to a service there just about 3-4 weeks ago, and it was, you know, open communion, and I've given, you know, adult forums there, and then others are, you know, extremely strict and precise. But sure, talk about that. Okay. One problem when we talk about mainline churches, I want to just get started on this. One problem is that we oftentimes, especially when we're analyzing them, tend to focus on the problems and the difficulties much more than on the strengths and the good things that are taking place in the churches. Because when difficulties arise, it's true in anything in history, and when difficulties arise, it's because there's been some new situation which causes conflict. And if we didn't have conflict, obviously we wouldn't have change. This is just kind of theoretical background. If we didn't have conflict, we wouldn't have change. And so therefore, there are those who want nothing more than to stand pat. And there are the ones, on the other hand, those who want nothing more than to change as, you know, as often as possible. There's an old, you know, saying in history about some politicians that, what is it, come weal or woe, my status is quo. or there's one, a sign in front of the library, in the library checkout desk, that says, but we've always done it this way. Right, and to have to go online, this was a major change that took place, and myself, it took me 6 weeks of learning, you know, to get online and talk about breaking through old habits, because I was, you know, I can write on a typewriter and suddenly all this thing, that little cursor just kept going and it never went the right way. And it took 6 weeks for me to break through, and I told my wife, I'd much rather have gone through basic training or go through boot camp than go through those 6 weeks again. And then finally one day, because the manuals are totally illegible and you can't use them, and finally, you know, then you do something and you write it down, and you know, wrong commander. Then sometimes they even put down something like bad commander. I mean, why use the word
bad?
Why make it moron? I mean, I'm used to making mistakes, that's no problem, or error or something else like that, but bad commander. I need some, you know, and then Ruth said she heard words from me that she didn't know that I knew, and barracks language that I got used to, and so on. And then finally, one day, after writing things down and nothing happening, and then by this time the fellow who was sold me the computer wouldn't even talk to me on the telephone. Finally, I hit print screen and it worked, and I started to cry. That's the only thing I remember. The only response that was available at that time. And then what happened? This was WordStar in 1987. And I learned that thing, and I learned it well. And now everybody says, well, you gotta try WordPerfect, you've gotta try this. I can't do any of them. I tried, I got a new system, I've got people who sit there and help me and everything else. And back to WordStar, you know, it's sort of like hieroglyphics is really what it's like, it's so ancient. But it works, okay. What does this have to do with change? Oh yeah, there we are. Rewind back to change here now. Change causes conflict, and so a lot of times when, especially outsiders and sometimes insiders, look at religious life in America, and what they concentrate on is just the conflict and all the difficulties and all the problems that are created. Sometimes, you know, sexual misbehavior, or they had about 2 years ago in the Episcopalian Church. Remember the treasurer absconded with, what was it, $2 million? Mm-hmm. And they got it back, but you know, that's what makes the headlines. I remember we were cruising through Utah or something, and we were listening to National Public Radio, and that they were going to say, here comes the religion news. And it's so rare that you get religion news on the radio anyway. We wanted to be sure, and then the whole thing was just on this, and it sounded like the Episcopalian Church was in total turmoil. It was in some turmoil, but you know, not total turmoil, and that was the impression. And what I'm trying to suggest here with the mainline churches, and this is true with the evangelical churches and certainly with the Catholic churches, also is that the real vitality and the real strength and I think the real story from a journalistic standpoint is not so much the conflict on the national level where you see all these things and the media thrives on conflict. What is it Walter Cronkite said? It's not news when you talk about how many dogs did not run away today. That's not news. But it is news when there's conflict and there's crime and all the rest of the things. And you know, I've just learned to hit the mute button when it comes to that stuff, listening to the radio. Okay, but where I find the strength in the, and this is, I think, interesting, and it tells us something about the mainline churches, the strength in the mainline churches is on the local level. If there's been any sort of trend in the last 10 years, 5 years, whatever, it's the thing we call downsizing or decentralization. The ELCA would be a good example of this. Everybody got all excited when we got the big merger. We finally got LCA and ALC and you know, Elam and all these people together. And the Methodists had their mergers and got things together. And we said, we're off to a new era. And they had the nice new, I shouldn't be sarcastic, but they had the new headquarters down at dear old 8765, isn't it, Higgins Road, West Higgins Road in Chicago, and all these things. And within 2 years, there was a $14 million shortfall, you know, in the ELCA treasury. It was the wrong thing to do at the wrong time, you know, in history. And we had, for instance, that the first treasurer of the ELCA was George Aker, and he got so fed up with it that he came up to St. Olaf. He said he'd do just about anything in order to get a job to get away from being on Higgins Road. Because Higgins Road, and this is true with other denominations too, and the Presbyterians found this also, was the idea that if you got a really strong, vital, you know, experimental sort of national program going, that you could sort of unify all the different elements of Lutheranism or any of the others around the country, and we'd have a strong, you know, kind of movement taking place. But by this time already, the decentralization, downsizing, you know, trend in all of politics has, you know, had started to occur. This is, I think, the thing behind the Republican takeover in Congress, for instance, also just the idea of downsizing and suspicion of centralization. and or not being impressed, at least, with centralization with this, and hence the real vitality is on the local level. Just for fun, I'd like to ask, how many of you participate in at least one activity in your church besides the weekly worship? How many do we? Yeah, that's true. I usually get about 90 to almost 100%, right? No matter if it's Catholic or Jewish or whatever it is. And this is where I think, and it's not just, this isn't just a captive audience. I found this with all kinds of different audiences that I found, and I think where the strength is. But that doesn't make doesn't get a lot of media attention, and doesn't show up on all the trends and all the rest of these things that are taking place. But I think here is where people see now that this is where we want the church to make a difference in our life. And what happens, down in Higgins Road or in New York, or if you're Missouri, Synod, if it happens from St. Louis or Salt Lake City or something else like this, not that important any longer for these denominations. This was brought home to me very vividly when I told some of you last night. I grew up in this very strict, traditional, Orthodox, conservative, Norwegian Lutheran piety back in southeast Minnesota. And I sort of thought this was the way, life, religious life was. And then when we moved to the Valley, at least for snowboarding, I started doing lecturing, and the Synod office sent me up to, we have a very lively group of Lutheran churches in Las Vegas. And it's the fastest growing city in the country. And so they took me to do some talking like this up in Las Vegas. And we got near the church, and suddenly I heard some loud jazz, very clear. And I thought, this isn't, holy, 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 or day full of grace or something else like that I was used to for Lutheran hymnology and these things. And I went in, and it was a jazzercise program taking place at the local Lutheran church. And I said, that's not the program I remember from my from my youth. But then suddenly it dawned on me, why not? Absolutely, why not? They're doing something worthwhile, they're taking care of their health, they get to socialize, and they're doing it within the boundaries of the church. And this is, I think, a way in which we have expanded the parameters, so to speak, or the boundaries of where we think the church should make a difference in our life. And the churches that are growing the fastest are the churches that we call the ones that are open 7 days a week. And the church isn't just a museum that you use for purposes on Sunday morning worship or something else like that. Okay. So with that in mind, let's turn to the specifics on the mainline churches. Now, yesterday we started with World War II, and I think for a long time, given what I mean by long in those years, for a long time, right during the war and after the war, I think most religious observers thought, and certainly leaders in Washington thought, that the main energy and the main thrust of American Protestant life was going to stay in the mainline churches. A very good example of this would be the creation in 1950 of the National Council of Churches building in New York City, what we call the God Box, right at good old 475 Riverside Drive, right up there, which if you've been there, is sort of a physical expression of mainline, of the 50s mainline, kind of religious life. You've got the God Box, and you've got Riverside Church is one of the great churches, of course, that's there. And you've got Union Theological Seminary, all within this very short period of time. And this was so imposing as a sort of a symbol of, the old time religion going into the 1950s and all the rest, that when the God Box was dedicated in 1958, President Eisenhower was there. Can you imagine the President of the United States going to a meeting like this? And everybody sort of thought that was simply the way life was. But then how politics changed. By 1988, this had so changed in favor of the evangelical and the fundamentalist churches that Liberty University, which is Jerry Falwell's university, gave an honorary doctorate to guess who? President George Bush. Can you imagine an Episcopalian in 1958 going to a fundamentalist college? No way. But in 1988, that's where the votes were. They didn't invite, a mainline. They didn't, you get the idea, okay. So the big story, though, was that starting in the 1960s, and this ties in with what we talked about last time, and the big story in the 1960s was that there has been, and really, since continues to be today, a rather serious decline in energy, in finances, and in membership in the mainline churches. For a long time, this was the big story, and I just to give you a couple of statistics, I don't like to read a lot of statistics. They put everybody to sleep. And then you also know that wonderful quip by Mark Twain about statistics. There are lies, there are damn lies, and then there are statistics, is what he said. And if I had a statistician there, they had apoplexy or something at this point, I'll call on you to bail them out, right? But that's true. Okay. The United Church of Christ, the UCC, shrunk 20% since 1965. The Presbyterian Church sank 20%. The Episcopalian Church, 28%. And the way the Lutherans coped with this problem of shrinkage is to merge. They took two things, both of them who were shrinking, and put them together and said, hey, we're growing. But now there was something like 5.2 million in the latest statistics. I've got good statistics if you're interested, and I've got the statistics in the mainline churches here for the last 5 years. I say this because once I had a statistician in class, and he liked statistics. So what I had to do was go out to the Xerox machine and Xerox the whole thing, and then he was satisfied when he got his statistics. But I've got all of them here if you're interested. You have to be careful with statistics because every so often the national office will tell people, let's tighten up and let's get rid of some of the deadwood on our congregational rolls. And they may well have been on the congregational rolls for a long time. But nobody sort of did anything about this. And then suddenly they decide, and it's a good idea, I think, to get rid of, you know, if you want to call it deadwood on the rolls. So it looks like in 1 year there's been a big drop, whereas actually they should have done this, you know, over a period of time, and the drop wouldn't have seemed quite so serious. Okay. The Methodist Church dropped 18%. What we call the Christian Church, the Disciples of Christ, after fact. Okay. You know, this is a man of science.
I thought he's your straight man.
He's a straight man, right. Yeah, right. If any of you are here next week, we'll have Elmer Witt here, and I was his straight man for a couple of programs, and we had a lot of fun with it. Okay. But anyway, and this, of course, this drop obviously has been of enormous importance for the mainline churches because of the lack of funds, and Robert Westnow from Princeton just has a brand new book out on this. It's a real crisis in the churches that are taking place, but also for a lot of people there has been, you know, what they think is a decline in the vitality of the churches. Some of the mainline churches have really become, the only word for it is museums. And the question becomes, you know, why the decline? If we started off, you know, the old-time religion with Eisenhower and John Foster Dulles, we talked about last night, and all these people, who was it? Franklin Clark Frye. There's a great name from the. His cover was on the his picture was on the cover of Time magazine, 1958. As an example, he was the great leader of the old LCA in Philadelphia.
Mr. Protestant.
I'm sorry?
Mr. Protestant.
Mr. Protestant, that's right. And Eugene Carson Blake, there would be another one. Mr. Presbyterianism, very important. Or the great leader in the Episcopalian Church before he, you know, lost it, and that was James Pike. And remember, they were going to talk about what they called COCU, Consultation on Church Unity, and it's still going ahead, but it doesn't get any attention anymore. But anyway, suddenly the great visions, you know, started to collapse and collapse, you know, in a hurry. And the reasons for this, I think, are worth going into, and I don't want to put you to sleep again.
I love statistics.
You could, all right. Some of my best friends, sorry.
I wouldn't want to marry one.
Yeah, that's there you go. I didn't plant him here, folks, really. They tell us something about the mainline churches and, you know, whatever happened to the old-time religion, which is the theme for this particular week. And they tried to explain it, and there have been a lot of different explanations, and the sort of the underlying, you know, theories really tell us a good deal about, you know, what we're interested in this week. One of the major reasons for decline in the mainline churches is that in the 60s, as we talked about yesterday, much of the agenda went political over the civil rights movement, over the peace movement, the ecological movement, or the women's movement drove some people out, and so on. They weren't going to put up with that sort of thing. And hence there was a dropout from a lot of people because they thought that the mainline churches were simply not doing what they were supposed to do, namely do what they had always done, you know, for a long time before. But once all the changes occurred with the things we talked about last night, that's why I put down that material for us for consideration last night, once this occurred, then obviously it started to break up the congregations. And there were those, and I've done a lot of interviewing, and as people said, our church just no longer had the spiritual vitality that it once had. And what they had really in mind was a church, and I don't say this critically, which really hadn't changed, even though, you know, much of America had changed, and much of American society had changed. And they wanted sort of the little brown church in the veil kind of thing there, where everybody knew their place, and you went and you did things, you know, the way they had always been done. And they didn't find this in these churches. And then it also has to be said, and this is true also, and I'll talk about this with the Catholics on Friday, it also has to be said that many of the churches who didn't get involved in things like the peace movement and all the rest got, the only word for it, went overboard with some of these things. Virtually anything close to what we would call worship or old traditional practices and all the rest of these things simply went out the window. And there was this great experimentation that took place. And I always like to use the example, and I probably will on Friday also. In the Catholic Church, would you ever have believed, you know, if you knew American history, that two Catholic priest brothers, you know, or any Catholic priest for matter, would go to jail? Can you imagine a Catholic priest in jail? And I'm talking obviously about Berrigan brothers. This was a, you know, this was an indication, and some people say, thank God they went to jail, because America is a corrupt, racist, imperialistic kind of nation, and we have to make our witness and take our stand. And you remember Daniel Berrigan twitted the FBI for a long time. He was able to hide out from them and sort of would focus for a little while, and then J. Edgar Hoover would say, here is this terrible threat to American society, so we have to get after him. Then he would hide and go underground for a while, and he made fools of the FBI for quite a while. Okay, he did that deliberately. But the point I want to make is obviously that some people cheered on the new political movement, the church, and some people also liked the new experimentation that took place. There was something in the Episcopalian church called the Underground Church. Malcolm Boyd, I don't know if that rings a bell with some of you who did things, and sometimes this was called the Coffee and Donut Eucharist. Where on Sunday morning, instead of going into one of the great temples like Grace Cathedral in San Francisco or others, which I, you know, love, and all the rest of these things, you would meet in somebody's kitchen or somebody's apartment, something else, and you'd have coffee and donuts for the bread and wine, and you'd probably have a picture of Che Guevara, you know, in the background instead of Jesus or the disciples or something like that, and then you'd all hold hands and sing Bridge Over Troubled Waters. Or Kumbaya, that's another one that's always a standard for underground church. And for these people, it was very meaningful. They went to the old traditional, you know, what we call, you know, what, you know, it's sort of like postmodernist critique, dull, white, male, European, you know, churches. And on the other hand, people didn't want that, so a lot of people dropped out for that reason. The church probably, I mean, the war, I think, probably more than anything else helped divide the churches. Because it was so difficult and so complicated for such a long period of time. Dan Erlander, who some of you know here, and his books have been recommended for you here, you recommended one of Dan's, was a pastor here for a while, and he said he had a church in, where was it, Albuquerque?
Albuquerque.
Yeah, where it happened. And he preached an anti-Vietnam War sermon, and the next day, a $10,000 a year, you know, donor dropped out. Dan knew that this would probably be the case, but did it anyway. And speaking of Dan's book, let me plug again the book, the Orange Book, which is in the bookstore there, if you're interested in following up on any of the things. I think it's very, very good. Another problem that comes, and put it this way, some people thought, sort of a variation of this, we don't have to go to church because what we get at church is something we could get from, you know, belonging to the local Democratic Party or the local League of Women Voters or the Association of, you know, University of Women or something else like that. The church was simply a forum, a debating society, where these things would take place. Or it became something to do with, let's say, with the arts, or with music or something else like that. Okay, so that helps explain it, and it helps explain how people were trying to cope with what, if you don't have the old-time religion, what do you put in its place? That's really sort of the point I'm trying to make here, the overall point. If you find the old-time religion, you know, missing or deficient or something else like that, what do you put in its place? And they've tried all sorts of different things, and they're still trying all sorts of different things by way of that, because the one, if you want to call it, advantage that the old-time religion had was everybody knew what was taking place. You may not like it, but at least you knew what was happening all the time. In my own congregation, we sang the same processional and the same recessional hymn for 20 years. It was number 72, holy, 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 going down the aisle, and Lord, dismiss us with thy blessing, going out the aisle. Number 72 and 10 in the old black hymn book. And I remember, you know, these every word. And Jimmy Hegvik and I were the ushers, and oh, Lord. never changed. People sat in the same place, you know. That, yeah, right. And we had one old wonderful Norwegian farmer in front of us, Martin Sorensen, and he had four dress shirts. And he would wear one for one different one each Sunday. And when it was the fifth Sunday of the month, you know, that happens twice a year, Martin would go back to the first one again. But he had his shirts in order. And if Martin would ever have not worn the same shirt, you know, the right third, this was the pinstripe, blue pinstripe on the third Sunday, then we would have really been upset because Martin wasn't supposed to do those things. And we wanted some security and stability in a world that's changing. Martin Sorensen wore his blue pinstripe on the third Sunday. And who was it? Ole Lee, right. You tell the kind of place I came from. Ole Lee always came 5 minutes late. That just drove my father crazy. He was absolutely, you know, why can't you plan, Ole, get up 5 minutes earlier and then come in? Ole had to come in 5 minutes late. Very difficult. All right. Kind of thing. But stability and order versus, you know, the change. Another one, and this is true, I think, with mainliners. Generally speaking, mainline people had more education, formal education, than those in the evangelicals and the fundamentalist churches, who I'll talk about on Thursday. And you can prove statistically, sorry to use the dirty word here, but you can prove statistically that people with more education have smaller families. And from the demographic standpoint here, it becomes clear that the membership in the mainline churches started to decline simply because there were fewer young people who came in. There weren't that around. There weren't that many around. And then in the 1970s and the 1980s, there developed, especially among the, you know, the young, urban, well-educated, high professional people, sort of a way of thinking that they can get what they want out of life without having to go through the churches. They developed, for instance, a physical fitness cult that gets started at that time with jogging and with all the food diets and all the rest of these things that take place. And people would spend Sunday, instead of in church, out jogging or meditating on their own or you know, whatever it might be with this, and simply didn't find the old traditional kind of churches, you know, all that rewarding. And I think another thing has to be said, right, is that the mainline churches did not, by comparison to the evangelical and the fundamentalist in the sects here, they did not do a good job of evangelizing. This is very important. For some reason, evangelicals, and I'm talking, when I mean evangelical, I mean here basically, you know, people sort of around Billy Graham and sort of thing, have a very strong emphasis on evangelizing and going out and witnessing and testifying. This is true also with the sects. For instance, we found that because there's so many Mormons down where we live in that area, that if there's a moving van coming in, Beacons or Mayflower or North American, whatever it is, within 2 hours there's a Mormon woman there with a casserole. And promises to take care of the kids for a while. Right. Not a hot dish, I've learned that, it's a casserole. That's important. And so on. But anyway, does that ring a bell? That they are very evangelistic and they're welcoming and they make people very, you know, make to feel that they really want them in the church. And you don't find this among, you know, among the mainline churches at all. For some reason, they don't go out and testify, as to use the evangelical term, you know, Jesus Christ is their personal Lord and Savior. But you say that to an evangelical, and you know, they all light up because that's exactly, you know, the phrase that's important to them, or washed in the blood of the Lamb, or being born again, or this sort of thing. You don't find that. And there, what's happened in this country is, and I'll talk about this with the mega churches too, there has been an enormous, you know, increase in population, especially huge numbers of people who have no background at all in anything we would call religious. And this is especially true in, you know, in the Sun Belt. And down where we live in Scottsdale, they can't build houses fast enough to meet the demand, you know, for houses and for churches. The church where we go is called New Covenant, right? If you know Scottsdale, it's Frank Lloyd Wright and Pima, right there. They have to decide how fast they want to grow because, statistics again, by the year 2000, they will have 6,000 more people living there within 5 miles. You know, honest. And how fast do you want to grow? How much of a mega church do you want to get? That's just astounding. You know, my home church in Kenyon, Minnesota hasn't changed 5 people, you know, in the last 50 years. So they don't have to worry about evangelizing. Okay. But out there they do. And what I'm trying to say is that the evangelical churches know how to reach these people. My brother was a pastor in Tucson, which is obviously very much in the Sun Belt, for a long time. And every so often, Curtis would like to go out door to door. and he'd wear his clerics and so on, and he'd knock and he said, I'm a Lutheran pastor. And then people down there say, Lutheran pastor, what's that? Is that something like Jehovah's Witness? And Curtis was not amused. He was very conservative and everything else. And he said, no, let me try to explain what that was. And then they expected him to give him a copy of the Watchtower, magazine, because that's what door-to-door people, meant. And what the mega churches have done is recognize that there is this enormous number of people who have no religious background at all. They don't even know that there are 10 commandments, not to say of what they were, or anything to do with the Lord's Prayer, the Apostles' Creed, anything like this means nothing to them. They haven't heard the great hymns, all these things. And as a result, when the evangelicals go out, and I talk about this at length on Thursday, they have been more effective, but the mainline churches haven't been able to keep up with this sort of thing. Because, and this will come to the thing I want on the board here, I have on the board, the mainline churches have as their background what we call the great tradition, as opposed to the little tradition. Now, those are just descriptive terms. Those aren't sort of evaluative terms. And the great tradition, this is Robert Redfield wrote a book on this, not Robert Redford, I don't talk that fast. But anyway, Robert Redfield wrote a book on this, the great tradition, the little tradition. He was an anthropologist at Chicago, University of Chicago. And the great tradition is that which is what we call religion from the top down. It's the religion of the seminaries and of the great cathedrals and of the great music and of Bach and all the great masses and the hymnology and formal teaching and very well educated clergy. On this sort of thing. And religious faith is understood in that which has already been determined. And it's in the liturgical tradition. It's in the sacramental tradition that we have here. We have the green books here, where everything, so to speak, is prepared. Or the other churches, the mainline churches in the liturgical sacramental tradition have this also. And we know what we're going to do. When a pastor has a baptism, he turns to page 121. And that's what it is. And I mean, I'm traditional and I'm sacramental and liturgical and all this, and I think that's right. But if you go to some of the other churches where people have no understanding and background at all about this sort of thing, what does that mean? That means very little to them. That's what I'm trying to suggest here. But the great tradition is really religion from the top down. It's religion, sometimes we use the term Eurocentric. It's the kind of faith that was developed in Europe, especially in the United Kingdom or Britain, in Germany, and then spread to Scandinavia, and it was brought over and transplanted here in this country, to use a sort of sociological analysis of this. And its roots, its nourishing, all these things come from Europe, whereas much of the evangelical and the other things, come from this country. The amazing thing is the one pure American religion is the Mormon religion. It's only in the United States. Every other major, and it's the seventh largest denomination now. Maybe some of you saw that. Was it Time magazine that had its cover story on Mormonism about a month ago? Yeah. And the seventh fastest growing one in the country now? Okay. So what I'm trying to suggest here is that the great tradition has survived for a long time. We send our children there, thank goodness. You send them to church colleges and all these things. We have our very carefully prepared programs and our liturgies. We hold fast to the traditions of John Knox or of Luther or Calvin, Wesley's, whoever we're talking about here. And that's the great tradition. For a long time that lasted, but what I'm suggesting here is that the mainline churches are in trouble because the whole thrust has been towards the little tradition. Downsizing, decentralization. Religion, to use this expression we worked out in history teaching, we call it religion from the bottom up rather than religion from the top down. There was a French historian named François Braudel who changed all the way in which we do traditional kind of history, because history had always been before what the people in Washington did, or London, or Berlin, or whoever it was, and that was what it was, and virtually ignored most of what we call the everyday life of ordinary people. That became a cliche, but this is the thing. And if you take now the whole thrust, and I'm sure Brad will talk about this with spirituality, Thomas More and all these people, it's spirituality in everyday life. The ordinary, everyday, common experiences are really what matter. Not the moments of, the great peak moments, or going to the great cathedrals, or the stained glass windows, or the rogue choirs, or the wonderful organs, or something else, but spirituality in everyday life. And this has much more of what I would call of an American source to it. On the frontier, you didn't have the time, you didn't have the opportunity for a learned clergy. And so you simply had to, if you wanted a church at all, you had to, you know, ad lib, you had to, you know, improvise. And we got the evangelical tradition, which is far different, obviously, than the liturgical. Does that make sense, what I'm trying to make, the difference between liturgical, I mean, between the great tradition and the little tradition on this? And the churches that are growing the fastest are the churches which, you know, go to the little tradition. Because a lot, I think a lot of times mainline churches scare people because you come in there and everything's already set, everything's already done. And you know, and you see people, you know, a young couple coming in and they, one is nudging the other one. What page are we on now? That's too bad. Are we on page 77 or wherever it is? And sometimes there it gives the impression that we're sort of, you know, above, you know, ordinary everything. What's the matter with ordinary everyday language? And why do we have to have all this, you know, ornateness? And for a lot of people, that's a real problem. And some of the mega churches have appealed to that by having, you know, much more down-to-earth sort of things. I remember the first time Ruth and I went to Community Church of Joy, which is ELCA, and in good standing with the ELCA, that has to be said, and all the rest. We were just going in, and I said, this isn't a church, this is a nightclub, because there was a snare drum and a saxophone and the, you know, bass guitar and all the rest of these things, and then, you know, holy, 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 and, you know, all the other things that I had grown up with. But I really think that the mainline churches have a problem here, which in a sense may be insoluble, because if to preserve their identity, to preserve what they really believe in, to hold on to the Westminster Confession, which is the, you know, the Presbyterian one, or the Augsburg Confession, or whatever it was, that means you have to make a statement that has been written 200-300-400 years before, but we consider still to be as relevant and as important in life as it, in our life today, as it was then. And for huge numbers of people, this simply, you know, is a very little, if any, any importance at all. And the evangelicals who are growing are the ones who have, you know, the programs moving in another direction. Is this helpful on the making the difference between the, you know, Carol?
Yeah, this is all interesting. As an ancillary point, I would like to hear your opinions about what I've experienced as a certain anti-intellectualism in the bottom-up churches. Yeah.
Yes.
And a loss of cultural heritage.
Yes. Oh, you know. Yeah, that's one thing I talked a little bit about last night was the decline of the ethnic churches, and my best story there is a wonderful man. It fits in with the Catholics, but I can tell it here just as well with it. The Catholic Church also faces, you know, enormous financial problems, and so they've had to close down some parishes. Wasn't it Chicago? Cardinal Bernardin had to shut down about a third or something of the parishes because they couldn't make it any longer. And in Detroit, which is very Polish town, they had to close down many. And this got to be news. This is sort of the news that, you know, CBS and NBC always picks up on. And so they had Dan Rather interviewing a wonderful woman from a Polish church in Detroit. Some of you know what Hamtramck, it's a very solid Polish area there. And she was talking, you know, how do you feel about the church closing down and everything? She said, I know what had to be done, and the cardinal did what he had to do. But he said, I'm still going to miss my Friday night Polish bingo blessing. And the old sort of things, it really wasn't a Catholic rite, but it was important to her because it was Polish. And today, with our much greater homogenization, clearly the ethnic church is virtually something now that is important really only to historians. We tried to have a sort of a revitalization in ethnicity a few years ago, 20 years ago. There was a historian at the University of Illinois named Marcus Lee Hansen, and wrote a book on this, and he created what we call Hansen's Law of History about ethnics and immigrants and all these things. He said the third generation tries to remember what the second generation tried to forget. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that lasted for a generation. I'm going to use that especially on Saturday when we talk about the Jewish ones, because this is even more influential for, you know, how do you hold on to the old and the new and the Reformed Jews and the conservative and Orthodox and all these things. But I think that was true for a while. For a while there was this flourish of ethnicity, but usually what that meant was that somebody said you buy ethnic food on Friday on the way home and have it and think that you're, you know, keeping your ties up with the old country. And back in, I don't know if they have it here, but in Minnesota we still have it with lutefisk dinners. And but nobody sort of kids himself any longer that they go out for anything more than, you know, socialization, not keeping the ties with the old one, except a politician. Somebody I was talking to breakfast today, we knew that the Lutefisk dinner still had vitality in Minnesota because the candidate for the United States Senate, Ron Grams, came down to one of the big Lutefisk dinners near Northfield when he found out there were going to be 500 registered voters there. And took his picture, you know, he had his dark blue suit off, a suit coat off, I should say, and his shirt sleeves rolled up, and he was supposed to be, you know, fixing Lutefisk or something. But anyway, the ethnic thing, I think, has made a difference. But within the evangelical church, by contrast to the mainline churches, there has been for a long time an anti-intellectualism. And what's fascinating to me, I've got a lot of good connections at Wheaton College and at Kelvin. I've done a lot of research. Billy Graham has a marvelous research facility right on the campus, and I've done a lot of my work there, is that there has been a resurgence within the evangelical churches, using Wheaton and Kelvin as my examples here, and you could use other ones, Gordon and others also, of trying to regain sort of a sense of intellectual respectability within the evangelical community. And we have their chief vehicle has been a magazine called Christianity Today. And it is a long ways away from sort of the even anti-intellectualism that you found before. But I think they are trying there, and basically it's a standoff. Some people want learned, well-prepared sermons and carefully prepared liturgies and all the rest, and other people want, you know, plain and simple and ordinary sort of things and spontaneous sort of things. And the churches really, I think, are in a real dilemma there, because no matter what you do, you can't please all the people all the time. And I think this is a good example would be in the liturgies, because sometimes some of the great liturgies are there, but a lot of people don't understand them, and what they want are much more simple and ordinary sort of things, and what we call praise music. The Gaithers, does that rings a bell with any of you, or Gloria and Bill and all the rest of these things? I don't know. Now, I have to explain, you're not from Minnesota, but you would appreciate, this is what we call a Hubert Humphrey answer to your question.
He had two sides of his mouth.
Hubert could take a very simple, straightforward question such as yours and turn it into a half an hour lecture and not know that he had done it. We miss him. You know, when you look at some of the people today, boy, I always figure anybody who was married to Mary Hill couldn't be all bad. And so on. But my best Hubert Humphrey story is he was vice president, and he was on Meet the Press or whatever it was, Face the Nation, and it was Larry Spivak was the MC at that time. And they asked Hubert a really tough question. I mean, it really, because when he was with Johnson thing, and Hubert knew it was a tough question and didn't want to give a direct answer. So he started to filibuster. That's the only word for it. He started to talk, and after about 5 minutes, Larry said, you know, Mr. Vice President, we're getting there. Yes, I know, I'm coming to that. Kept on going. About 10 seconds later, he said, well, you haven't answered the question. And he said, well, give me a chance. And then finally at the end, he said, sort of, we have to close now. And Hubert had sat there with this cat await the canary expression, you know, on his face. He had done what he was supposed to do. He had filibustered. So that's what I just did with yours, was to filibuster. Yes, there is some anti-intellectualism, and it's popular with some circles. And in other places, they are trying very hard to, you know, overcome this.
And, I haven't seen evidence of that.
Oh, well, what? No, maybe not in some circles. That could well be. One place you can look for, I know the college world, is where do the evangelical colleges go for their teachers? And there has been a move to try to get more of their teachers from Harvard, Columbia, Chicago, Stanford, the quality kind of college. They have tried to do this, because that's always, I think, a very good sort of sign. And other ones still sell for, you know, what we call Slippery Rock Teachers College and other places like that. But I think that's, there is a Slippery Rock Teachers College in Western Pennsylvania, isn't it? Right. And I'm not, you know, you get the other ones too. Okay, yes.
I'm wondering if one of the differences between the mainline progress and, or lack of progress, and the mega church, I've been thinking of the fact that they say that one of the biggest motivations for anybody is self-interest. Mm-hmm. The old message was, if you are baptized, if you believe in Christ, you will have eternal life, beautiful streets of gold, everything is wonderful, and you'll see your mother, and we're looking to heaven, And on the other hand, if you don't behave, and if you have unconfessed sin, and you should be called by the Lord in the 10 minutes you're going up there, you are in for eternal damnation. And the personal motivation is pretty strong. God wants you to tithe. And so we work for the Lord, and we work for the church, and we're called to work for God. And the reward is wonderful because there's heaven, and I better be careful because I certainly don't want the eternal punishment. Now, the megachurch says your reward is that you are going to have peace of mind, you're going to have a better life, you're going to be more successful, you'll be happier, but it's not that God wants you to tithe. We need the money, and we need your help to do this project, and so forth. Now, the mainline church changed the message from, you are going to get this wonderful reward, and if you don't, better watch out, because you're in for something you better avoid. But now the message is, through the honesty of looking at things, is there are people in the world suffering, there are justice issues, there's poverty, and we need to work to change the world so that the world will be better. Where is the personal reward in that? And so there's self-interest is lost in a wonderful message that it needs to go out.
Yeah, let me put it another way. There was a famous book that came out by a United Methodist pastor named Dean Kelly, came out in 1972, and he noticed a thing that mainline churches were declining in membership and conservative churches were growing in membership. And he said, that's not supposed to happen because American society is supposed to be becoming much more secular, much more worldly, much more loose. You know, the whole thing with pornography and drugs and crime and all the sexual revolution. And here he said, in light of all these so-called secular worldly trends, we're getting people who are joining churches enthusiastically, and they are expected to listen to what the church wants from them. They're expected to make some sacrifices. They're expected to conform to what the churches sort of expect from them. And even today, the Mormon church continues to grow, and the Jehovah's Witness and some of these others. And he asked the question, why should this be the case? And his argument was that the mainline churches didn't expect enough from their people. The mainline churches often, I was using this a little bit last night, tend sometimes to lapse into feel-good stuff rather than preach what we would call the message from the from the great tradition. What can the church do for me? I've got my problems, and I'm going to bring them to church, and this church is supposed to be done, to do something for me. And obviously, you could get that from your psychotherapist or from your counselor as much as you could from the church. And a lot of the what we would call the spiritual nourishment and the strength really of the mainline churches, I think, was in a very real sense lost there. Because they didn't expect much, that much from the people. But those who wanted to belong to a church, and the Mormons were very good at bringing them in and holding them there, were informed that if you're in the church, you're expected to do this and you're expected to do that. Sort of a good visual example of this is if you drive by a Mormon church or a temple, say even late Sunday afternoon, the parking lot is still full. When you go to church on Sunday or the Sabbath for the Mormons, you're there all day. And there are programs and things arranged for the family and for everybody else at that time. And in a lot of Protestant churches, if the minister goes 1 minute over an hour out, we never go back there again. And I've had people tell me that. And so what the mega churches have done then is arrange the parking thing so that they've got people out there with the orange wigwag, flags and everything else, and move them in and out because that's what the people want. And I think it's a good point that you raise with this sort of thing. How far can you go? And I'll talk about this with the financial thing in expecting financial support. We all know the squeeze of the economy today, and one place in people's budgets that is flexible would be the church, what they give to the church. And so there has been a decline there. And that then what happens is that if you don't have sort of a financial investment in the church, you're much less loyal, much less likely to take as much interest in the church as if you had, you know, kept up your donations there. And you mentioned Missouri, and Missouri is very strong on this, on expecting things from their people. I think that's one reason, as strange as it might sound, that Missouri continues the what vitality it has. Because it's rather clear what's expected from them that way. On the other hand, my own first personal feeling is that Missouri is, this is prediction, and I'm a historian, I'm supposed to deal with the past and not with the future. But in fun in a place like this, I can break out of the old mold. But I think with Missouri, there's going to be a real generational problem there, because the younger people, and you've got good statistics on this, simply aren't as interested in preserving, you know, pure doctrine the way Missouri is. Because Missouri and Wisconsin are very firm on holding to, you know, traditional kinds of doctrines. And if somebody is a little bit suspicious on virgin birth or physical resurrection or something else like that.
Ordination of women.
Ordination of women, close communion, right? Oh, yeah. There was one there was a Concordia College in St. Paul, and one sociology professor wrote an article saying, let's at least consider ordination of women. He didn't say, let's do it, let's consider it. He was fired. I mean, just like that, infamous kind of case with this. And my own feeling is that given enough time here, the younger generation isn't just going to be interested in those things any longer. And Missouri also spends, you know, an enormous amount of time fighting among themselves over, you know, the orthodoxy of their leaders. When they got rid of, I'm trying to think of the name, Ralph.
Bowman.
Bowman before, and brought in Barry. The pro-Berry people spend an enormous amount of time and money. They send out videos and pamphlets and everything else. And some Missouri pastor, the one in Northfield, who I, you know, dearly like very much, said, what if all that time and energy could have been spent, you know, preaching the gospel instead of trying to depose, you know, the incumbent president? So that would be my own feeling. And with German, with the Missouri thing, I think there's an ethnic thing there. You mentioned it, that eventually there aren't going to be that many sort of people interested in holding on to the old Germanic, you know, tradition and the language and everything else and the culture that still motivates much of Missouri today. You respect that, but it seems as though it's almost like an anomaly, that it's something, you know, out of place right now.
That I noticed in Minnesota that both Wisconsin and Missouri, but particularly Missouri Senate, is doing very well in suburban communities. It's an interesting thing and around the country.
They got into the church growth movement.
Yeah.
Strange sort of thing for, you know, Missouri, because that's all very highly bureaucratized and computerized and standardized in terms of how you go out and recruit and all these other things. And that'd be my, you know, my fearless prediction on what will happen. Maybe I'm all wrong, but I can't imagine. Well, we were, when we decided to retire, we had some friends. Well, Bruce's sister has lived in Florida, and they wanted us to come down and retire there, and we were looking around, and we finally realized we couldn't go to Florida because we couldn't go to the same church that her sisters went to. And, that's a strange sort of, or if we did go, we couldn't go to communion, you know, at her sister's church, and so we went to Arizona.
Well, I was just thinking, in pan-Lutheran organizations like Holden Village and Lutherans Concerned and Global Health Ministries, we need to be careful that we are, ELCA is a majority, but we're not the whole Lutheran
That's
church.
Right.
And when we're talking about Missouri Synod, Wisconsin Synod, and breakaway evangelicals, association of churches or whatever, we may disagree very strongly as individuals, but there needs to be, I think there needs to be a mutual respect they may be real wrong, but we still, they have reasons for believing what they're believing.
Yeah, they look at Martin Luther very carefully, and a lot of them are very, very well-trained scholars, and I respect that very much. But
I said that for the tape.
Oh, I see. All right. We didn't want to get your name into on the tape?
No. My name is Carl Johansson.
Well, Missouri's been such a great part of, you know this story better than most of the rest of us, part of Holden and origins. And
Missouri was
in the Missouri, and that's why I raised the question, because Missouri has been many parts of American Lutheranism, and particularly at Holden.
Yeah, they were in on
that. The strong contribution that they've given and still give.
Yep, right. They were in on it. It's one of the few places where there's direct, you know, one-to-one or hands-on cooperation, because they're on the board here and so on. But then Barry, the president there, spoke to the ELCA convention. And virtually, you know, I thought maybe this would be enough to swing the vote for pro-Episcopalian vote, because he said, we've had some strains in the last few years between between us and ELCA, and we don't want you to vote in favor of this, you know, this union. And I thought that should do it. I mean, Barry says I'm going to vote the other way. Yeah, right. So anyway, it's I like to be on time, and it's we like to have 10 minutes before the first setting. So we don't ring the bell at the end of the session, so we'll see you Thursday if you're here. And I'll be here, I forget what time it is. It's probably 3:45, I haven't talked to that one. But tomorrow I've got dish team, so I'm gonna get rested for that one. Okay, thank you.